Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Stack Overflow podcast, a place to talk all things software and technology. I am Ben Popper, Director of Content here at Stack Overflow, joined, as I often am, by my wonderful colleagues and collaborators, Cassidy Williams and Sior Ford. Hey, y'all.
Hi.
Hello.
So it's a bit of a heat wave. We're going to try to keep things cool today. We have a great guest, Heather Meeker from OSS Capital. And Cassidy, full disclosure, you also work with OSS, right?
Yeah. And I'm very excited to talk to Heather more deeply because she's incredibly legit and knows everything. I guess terrific. That's a slight exaggeration, but not really.
Right. Too legit to quit, for sure. Yeah, it's funny. What a small world. We were just discussing. I know some folks from Dev2 and OSS who also moved to my little section of the Hudson Valley, so part of the exodus from New York City. But anyway, we're very excited to chat all things open source. Heather, welcome to the Stack Overflow podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So we usually ask folks to start us off by just giving us a quick flyover. What brought you into the world of software and technology?
Well, I learned to program when I was 8.
Wow.
I learned more later. Listen, but my first little program was when I was 8. My dad taught me, and this is a podcast, so maybe people can or can't tell, but I'm no spring chicken. So this was a long time ago, 1968, that would be. And my dad was actually working in a computer lab, which at the time was an extremely strange thing. In fact, it was so strange, and people were so uninformed about what computers were that when people asked me what he did for a living, I used to tell them that he was a spy because it was easier to explain than right. to say what he was doing, which was actually pretty complicated. Anyway, so, you know, he kind of introduced me to it. And I guess I was always kind of interested in logic and, you know, systematizing things. I just the kind of person I am. And then when I got into college, I was going to summer school and it was really hot. And the computer science lab had air conditioning. So I took a couple of computer science classes. Now, I was at a liberal arts school and I don't even think it had a major in computer science. And not a lot of schools did at the time. And so I learned Fortran and I think SPSS, which was this old statistical program.
Wow. Cool.
So I thought that was really fun and interesting. And then when I got my first job, there was a computer in the basement and I figured out where it was and talked the operator into letting me use it and so that I could save myself effort doing my job, which had really nothing to do with computers. Anyway, I was always interested in it. And then shortly after that, I got a job as a computer programmer. That was when we called ourselves computer programmers, which is, I don't know if that's really what people call themselves anymore.
Less job title-y. I think they'll say, like, oh, yeah, I'm a programmer.
Yeah. I go to that for a synonym after I've written developer or software developer.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a programmer or coder, but it's definitely something you see in a job description.
But I worked writing application software for what at the time was called mini computers, which were something smaller than a mainframe, but they didn't really have desktop computers yet. And yeah. So, I did some programming work for a while. And then very stupidly, probably, I decided there's no future in this job. I'm going to do something else. So I did some other things, including work as a musician and go to law school. But then when I graduated from law school, I was really interested in software and technology. And so I decided to go into law practice doing software deals. And I did that for, I've done that for nearly 30 years. And I got into open source in particular pretty early on, like in the late 1990s. And I was just fascinated by it. And I was interested in software and I knew a little about software. I mean, everything I knew was completely outdated. So, yeah. Had to kind of extrapolate, right? But very interested in it. And it was great to help, clients get their goals done in the software space. And then I joined OSS Capital a few years ago. It was a little I guess, unexpected for me to go into venture capital because I'm not really a finance person. But by that time, I had been working with so many clients on business strategy around open source that it was kind of a natural move. So that got me where I am today. I still do a little programming kind of for fun. I'm very bad at it. But but sometimes it's fun. You go, I really need to do this thing. Maybe I'll write a little program to do it.
Sweet. What a great history. Cool, Thank you for sharing that. I have a couple little questions just because I want to get the history right. So your father, he was a spy, but maybe you could tell us, like, what was he working on in the 70s and what was the language that he was teaching you? Was it also Fortran or something else? Oh,
he taught me BASIC first. Yeah. He worked at it's kind of a think tank in the late 60s and early 70s. And then he set up a computer-based behavioral lab. I think I'm not really sure what exact languages he was using or anything. I mean, it certainly was old ones like maybe Fortran and BASIC and things like that. Right.
And then just one other quick history question, and I'll pass the mic to Cassie and Ciro. But you mentioned you got into open source in the 90s. What were the projects that were emerging then at the beginning of the open source world that you were involved in or hearing about that got you interested in this area?
Oh, well, so at the time, of course, everyone was interested in Linux. Mm-hmm. That was the granddaddy of them. And of course, it was because it was under GPL, that was the license that like nobody understood. So part of what I was doing was trying to help people understand it. And don't get me wrong, it's not like I really understood it. I was like learning along with them.
Sure. Somebody's got to interpret the law for the first time, right?
That was, And then the Apache projects were, many of them were well underway at the time. If I can say one thing about like GPL and figuring out what it means and everything is that lawyers don't really have any incentive to take chances. They're supposed to give conservative advice. And perhaps because I was like unsuited to be a lawyer, I don't know. I was one of the ones who was like willing to say, well, okay, this is what I think this means, and this is probably your best choice, even though there was no law and like almost nothing to go on. So not many people at the time were interested in kind of walking out on the wire in that way. I was more driven by what was interesting and what my clients needed, for rightly or wrong.
That makes, move fast and break things isn't legal advice, but it's certainly interesting.
But it's fun. One question I wanted to ask was, you've been in the open source space since the 90s. How have you seen it like grow, change, evolve from like starting out with like the Linux projects and the Apache projects and things like that?
Well, that's a good question. At the beginning, it was considered sort of the purview of hobbyists and a sort of a group of people that like most people outside that group found impenetrable, right? They didn't understand what they were doing or why they were doing it or what these licenses meant. And then as we moved into the 2000s, it just like, it took off like a rocket, right?
Oh, wow.
And all of a sudden, everybody was using open source. Like when I started, a lot of people were saying, no, that's too dangerous. We can't use it. We don't understand it. And then you fast forward to 10 years later, 15 years later, it's everywhere, which is an enormous sea change, right? And things don't usually happen that fast, a paradigm shift like that. So it was like really interesting and exciting.
So how did you like navigate that increase in participation in like the open source space?
Well, first of all, I just kept getting a lot more questions about it. I mean, I was sitting at my desk working on software deals. And the way that things work in organizations is if you know 10% more than the person like at the next step, you're the expert.
You're the subject matter expert.
So, you know, people would keep asking me about things and then people kept, other people kept calling me about it. And it was just like, I kind of thought it would be the flavor of the month, you know, and it was kind of this interesting, weird little thing that was happening. And then all of a sudden it was everywhere.
Right.
And so you know, I just kept trying to learn more about it. And as I said, like nobody really understood it. So I was just thinking, okay, I have to do my best to tell my clients what to do because they need answers, right? So that's kind of what happened during that process.
Cassidy, you brought this up once before. Heather, I'd be curious to hear it in this context. You're doing software deals, companies acquiring one another or working together. Were the questions about, hey, if we use this open source project, can we then sell our company? Or if we buy this company that's using open source, can we then patent the software? Or were people more just curious, you know, how should we approach this? Like, where was that intersection of law and business and open source that you worked on?
Yeah. So, you know, in the world of tech entrepreneurship, the question is always, can we sell our business, right? Are we doing something that will cause us to have trouble selling our business? By the way, tip for young lawyers, if you want clients to pay attention to what you say, is, if you do this, your stock will be worthless. Right. That line always...
You were already thinking like a venture capitalist. Can I sell this business at some point down the road?
But yeah, they were very concerned about risk and how things would look in investment transactions and acquisitions. They were concerned about how open source interacted with patents and trademarks too. And sorting out all that stuff was... you know, you had to extrapolate from existing rules and figure it out. So yeah, they were asking all sorts of questions like that. And then the basic question people were asking was, I want to do this with the software. Can I do that? How do I do it without violating the license? And that's, you know, what we spent a lot of our time on.
Very cool.
It's so interesting because this is a side of like open source software that I never even considered. I never thought about like the lawyer licensing side of things before. So it's interesting to hear your insights around like what that whole process looked like. And then like starting from scratch, since this was such a new thing, like having to come up with that kind of stuff. I just never thought about that before. That's so cool.
Well, I mean, it may sound like I'm tooting my own horn here, but unless there was somebody like me in a role like mine, like an outside counsel who was knowledgeable about intellectual property, to tell clients this is okay to do, it couldn't have gotten adopted in business, right? And so that was actually important to me to play that role, like to try to talk people off the ledge and say, no, you can really use this stuff and it won't be catastrophic for your business. Because at the time, there was a lot of FUD out there about open source and, you know, various people were trying to say it was too dangerous to use and risky and stuff, which is actually turned out to be extremely wrong.
Right.
But to explain why it was wrong, you had to construct a lot of logic in that was an important role.
Yeah. How have licenses evolved? Like, you mentioned the GPL license, but there's also like the MIT license and all of these other like standard ones that you see in repos all over the place.
Well, the new ones are a little better than the old ones were. Like the old ones, you kind of wonder as a lawyer, like who came up with this stuff? I mean,
not lawyers.
Was it me?
Somebody on an email listserv somewhere.
No, I think the early ones were written with the idea that they would never be, well, like the things like MIT and BSD, I don't think people understood how important and pervasive those would be. And so they were written a little bit on the casual side. I mean, they're from a legal point of view, they're written in a very vague way. And many lawyers over the years have asked me about what they mean, you know, and because they just can't figure it out from looking at them. Like they think that BSD is like a copyleft license, which it's not, just because of the way it's worded. So the early ones were kind of casual. And like for legal documents, that's not a good thing. And then there were the copyleft licenses. Like GPL is really, it's written almost as a political statement rather than a license. And then there's a lot of detail in it, but it's not written the way a lawyer would write a license, for better or worse. And then there were some that came after that, like Eclipse and Mozilla and some of the others that actually preceded those. And those were more like traditionally written. So for lawyers, they were easier to understand. And then if you go to the really modern ones, I think the craft of drafting open source licenses has improved greatly as more people got involved in it and more people who had experience drafting licenses.
Right. That's interesting. Were those early ones written more, from like a mission-driven perspective of software developers who wanted to foment open source, but maybe, as you pointed out, didn't have a ton of legal training to craft the language in that way?
Yeah. Well, first of all, to be clear, they were trying to do something as really had never been done before. Okay. So there wasn't like a way to do it. Mm-hmm. And they did have legal advice, but I don't think they wanted the licenses to sound like traditional licenses. Mm. They wanted them to be developer manifestos, and that's what they were. It's just that then when people ask their lawyers, can we use this stuff? And someone had to say yes in order to green light the use, then the lawyers actually had to understand it. And if you ask people who wrote those first licenses, you know, they would probably say, oh, well, this is perfectly comprehensible to developers. I'm not sure that's exactly right, but it certainly wasn't comprehensible to lawyers.
Okay. Unless anybody had any more questions about licensing? No? Yes?
I guess my last question would be, do you have a favorite license, like a go-to, where you're just like, this is what you should use on your projects?
Well, those are maybe two different questions. So like from a drafting, like from a craft of drafting, right? Most of these things are drafted by committee. So, you know, it kind of limits the absolute quality of it. And this will probably be self-serving, but I was on the drafting team for Mozilla 2, and I think that was very good work product. I think, you know, I know the people who worked on it worked really hard to get it right, and we did have to work with starting from Mozilla 1, but we really did a lot of work on that. And then, you know, GPL3 and LGPL3 and so forth, those are much improved, you know, compared to the earlier versions. As to like what I recommend people use, like honestly, if it really depends on what the objectives of people are. It's very important to use licenses that everyone understands. So even if there were a perfect license out there that nobody used, it wouldn't be the right license, because part of open source and getting people to participate is they have to understand what you've done. And the great thing about open source is it's at this point very standardized. So there are about 6 licenses anybody uses. And so it makes almost no sense to pick any but those 6, because then you're just making people educate themselves about what you're doing. I sometimes call that the understanding tax, right? So, you know, that's usually not going to accomplish your goals if what you want to do is have people adopt and use and contribute to the software.
Yeah.
We talked a lot about your experience as a lawyer with open source licensing. I want to hear how that you made that transition into venture capitalist work. So were you like approached? Is this something that you had in mind that you wanted to do, and then you decided to like somehow figure out how to get into it? I want to hear more about that.
Well, I was plucked out of my lawyering by JJ, Joseph Jacks, who was starting this fund that specifically invests in early stage commercial open source development. Mm-hmm. So just for context, like, it's very unusual for a fund to have a focus that specific, but that's what he wanted to do. And then he came to me and said, would you be interested in being involved? And my first reaction was, what do you want me for? Like, I'm just a lawyer. but then as I thought about it, I realized that I had actually been spending a lot of my time focusing on strategy instead of pure legal advice by that time. And so I thought, well, actually, this kind of makes some sense and it sounds really fun and interesting. And so I said, okay, I'll get involved in this. And it was great. I was close to retirement by that time as a lawyer. And so this changed like the whole trajectory of my career, right. Probably in a good way, because I was getting honestly a little burnt out on the lawyering stuff. I've been at it for a long time. So yeah, I just got picked, right?
Right. Well, you have all this great experience in it. And also, as you said, working in like mergers and acquisitions and stuff like that, that relates to venture capital or advising people on, you know, areas where their shares might be worth less or worth something. I think those all tie nicely in.
It doesn't hurt.
Doesn't hurt. Cassie and I have been on a number of shows where we talked about this. And I know, Cassie, you have personal experience working with folks, but you mentioned that the idea is to invest in commercial open source. So I'm curious, what makes for a successful commercial open source project from your perspective? Because many open source projects have been created that go on to have great success in terms of the number of developers who use them, even large enterprises who use them, how popular and, you know, sort of productive they are for the whole ecosystem, but they don't function well commercially. So when you think about it from that perspective, what is it that allows something to be open source and then, as you pointed out, like widely understood and adopted, but also be a successful commercial venture and therefore a successful venture investment?
Right. Well, it's a good point. I mean, first of all, there are plenty of open source projects that are not commercial ventures, and that's great. You know, that's a separate thing. But if you want to make a business around an open source project, you have to do a little bit of planning about how you're going to accomplish that, because the open source software is free. And even if you pick a license like GPL or a Faro GPL, that will not prevent people from using your software to compete with you. So you have to think, like, what are we really selling here? Because it's not the open source code, right? Mm-hmm. And the way I like to characterize this is, like, customers don't buy source code. That's just not what they buy, right? It's a tool. They buy products or services. So you have to figure out what products or services you're going to be selling if you're going to make a successful business. And it's perfectly possible to make a successful business around an open source project, but you're not selling the project. You're selling something different. For instance, you could be selling hardware. You could be selling managed services. You could be selling, you know, use what we call an open core model and have some complementary software like an enterprise edition that you charge people for. There are actually, you know, at least, you know, half a dozen different common variations. But the most important thing about it is to be realistic about how you get from a project to a product to a company. And I like, this may date me a little bit, but I don't know if you remember like the underpants gnomes on South Park, right? So they had like step one, collect underpants. Step three, profit. And then there's a big question mark in the middle. And I, you know, unfortunately,
I don't think I realized that was the origin of that.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen it so much, but I didn't realize that's where it came from.
Unfortunately, like some open source developers think, like engage in some magical thinking, like we're going to have this really successful project and then we're going to make lots of money. Well, you have to figure out what the question mark in the middle is.
Right.
And like GitHub stars don't make you money, right? So
can't eat GitHub stars.
So yeah.
I think my last question for you is, you mentioned you were a musician. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because it was a little stint where I was just like, wait, what was that?
Sure. Well, let's see. After I graduated from college and I worked, I eventually moved back to LA where I was from and I was working as a computer programmer. And then I decided I wanted to become a musician, right? So I'm a drummer and a singer and a songwriter. And so I decided to go to music school. So I went to this school that it doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. It's like a trade school. It's like a one-year certificate program. Huh. And I took the percussion program. And then I got into working professionally more as a musician. I will say that certificate program was the most difficult school I ever went to. including college and law school.
You're telling me drumming is harder than
programming? Mainly because I didn't have enough talent, but you know.
That makes me feel good.
But actually, one thing I learned during that that experience, I love music, right? And I love playing the drums, and I love, you know, writing songs and everything. But one thing I learned was that there were people around me in school who were truly talented, and it was just shocking what they could do. And I was in such great awe of what they could do. And I am a person who is diligent. And so, like, diligent people can get pretty far doing something, even if they don't have a lot of talent. And that's what I was like as a drummer, certainly. I mean, but I realized that, and then I became like a band leader. So I had pretty good organizational skills, you know, and I wasn't, you know, on drugs. So like, I was capable of like bringing a group together and taking them out to play professionally. And I, you know, I knew a lot about music by then, having studied it. So I became a little bit more of a band leader than just a player. And then I would hire drummers to play in my band because they could play way better than me, and they like hardly charged anything.
Drummers are notoriously the ones who don't show up on time for the gig if they show up at all. So. Band leader makes
sense. That's because they have more equipment than everybody else.
Sure, that's why.
So can we buy your albums anywhere?
What's your band camp?
I have never tried to do that. I actually just recently got all my old stuff digitized. That was a huge effort because it was all on, you know, obsolete media.
8-track.
And in of all different kinds. Right. I mean, of a stunning variety, right? And I had to find people who could handle all these different media. But so I saved them from oblivion, or they're only in partial oblivion.
Amazing. My last question is, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the Web3 world and the blockchain world and what people are interested in achieving there. And a lot of developers and folks who are interested in it are keen on it because in some ways they feel it's distributed, that no single entity has control, and that it will allow people to, you know, sort of collaborate in creating things. But I guess one of the things I'm curious about is to what degree that offers something that the open source model, which, as you pointed out, you know, 30 years ago was seen as completely fringe and then dangerous, and now, you know, sort of fully accepted by many large businesses, can't offer. Do you have any thoughts for us on Web3 or blockchain and where that might sit side by side with an open source?
Sure. Well, they do have similar characteristics, like people collaborating collaborating for open source, but let's say people are participating in a market or something that is on a blockchain. You know, they're interacting asynchronously. They might not know each other. They might not know each other's personal identities. They could be all over the world, you know. And so those qualities are similar. And I think open source and the way people interact in open source laid the groundwork for that on a social level.
Interesting.
Kind of. But things like cryptocurrency are very different from open source in lots of ways. I do think that cryptocurrencies will eventually be very common, but I think most of them will be fiat currencies instead of the decentralized ones. And the reason for that is a practical one, which is that countries can't afford to have people operating outside the bounds of their economic control for taxation reasons and legal reasons and so forth. But blockchain goes way beyond that. And I think what most people don't see about blockchain is the way that it can help with all sorts of things other than cryptocurrency, right? So that is an extremely interesting idea. And if you build blockchains that are really reliable and don't destroy the environment, then it can be an extraordinary tool. I would liken it to what the web was in 2000,
right,
which was people who were, you know, just your average consumer or whatever. They thought the web was like Yahoo, or the web was eBay. And what they were not seeing was the way the web was being used to restructure the supply chain and completely change the way business was done on a practical level. I think we have an analogy in blockchain where it's going to underpin a whole lot of stuff that isn't crypto and that your average person would be completely transparent to them.
Right, right. Fascinating. Well, thank you so much for that. All right, everybody. It is that time of the show. We are going to shout out the winner of a lifeboat badge, someone who came on Stack Overflow and found a question with a negative score of 3 or less. They went ahead and gave that question an answer, and now it has a score of 3 or more, and that answer has a score of 20 or more. Why do we need abstract classes in Java? Yeah, why? Well, Keshlam has the answer and has been awarded a lifeboat badge. So thank you to Keshlam for spreading some knowledge around the community. Asked 8 years ago, viewed over 50,000 times. All right, everybody. I am Ben Popper. I am the director of content here at Stack Overflow. You can always find me on Twitter at Ben Popper. You can always email us with questions or suggestions, podcast@stackoverflow. And if you like the show, leave us a rating and a review. And if you like to hang out on YouTube or you prefer to see us as we chit chat, we now have video versions of the podcast up there. So go ahead, smash that subscribe button. If you want to see Cassidy without her glasses for the first time, you got to go to YouTube.
Watch out, world. My name is Cassidy Williams. You can find me at Cassidoo, CASSIDOO on most things. I do developer experience at Remote and at OSS Capital.
And my name is Yora Ford. I am a developer advocate at Auth0. You can find me on Twitter. My username there is Yorio. That's CEEOREO _.
And I'm Heather Meeker, a venture capitalist and lawyer. You can find me at oss.capital or heathermeeker.com. And by the way, I've written a book about open source licensing, which a lot of people find helpful and I make like no money on. You can get a free copy of it, downloaded, a free PDF copy, if you go to my website, heathermeeker.com, and hit the links tab or button or something, I guess. And it'll give you instructions on how to sign up for like a list to get updates about the book and also download the book and some associated materials. So great. Feel free to do that.
Is this book open source or can I profit off of it or just download it?
Nope.
Okay, got it. Just checking.
It doesn't really work for content so
well. Gotcha. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening and we will talk to you soon.
Bye.